This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 3 of TV Good, Sleep Bad, your monthly dose of cult and obscure TV goodness. Tonight is a very special show as we are actually joined by our very first guest ever. We're joined by Mr. Bubba Wheat. But before we obviously speak to him, I just of course have completely forgot to introduce my co-host as always, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Where? Oh, yeah, here. Hi. Hi, everybody.
And how's things off in your side of the world, Mr. Lackey?
Things are pretty good. I haven't had much time for actual television shows because I've I just got back from I had an actual real film festival late September, early October. So I'm gradually getting back into like non-movie related entertainment.
Yeah, because it was the Fantastic Fest you were over at recently, is that right?
It was.
I've been keeping up with like everything that's been going on and been incredibly envious because I've not been at a film festival and not had anything half as exciting to watch this week. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That's cool. As I said at the start, there we obviously got our special guest tonight. It of course gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show Bubba Wheat. For those who don't obviously know who Bubba Wheat is, he's basically, if you need to know anything about comic book TV shows or movies, he's the guy to go to, as he's slowly expanded his empire, starting off with Flight Tights and Movie Nights, and now more recently launching Channel Superhero to corner the TV side of superheroes. Welcome to the show, Bob Wheat, and obviously thank you for giving us our theme this evening.
Well, thanks for having me on. I seem to think that it was actually in part of like Channel Superhero that inspired you to do this show.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
It certainly was. I mean, obviously, you're currently at the moment doing the Tales from the Crypt blog on. Somehow you managed to round up, am I right in saying, 31 people to write?
Not quite 31, because we were just a couple short, and then I had myself on there twice. And then, of course, all three of us together, that's twice. So I think it's like 28 different bloggers.
Which is still impressive to add at 28, and obviously, like, you did a piece as well, is that right?
Yeah, I reviewed the very last actual episode of Tales from the Crypt, The Third Pig, which is the animated episode. It's an animated take on The Three Little Pigs with Bobcat Goldthwait as the big bad wolf.
Very nice. And obviously tonight, being our Tales from the Crypt special, we are obviously going to look at an episode from the show, and seeing as how your blogathon has covered many of the key episodes, we've actually gone with the episode Comes the Dawn from Season 6, and it's episode 13, perhaps only because it features Michael Ironside, which, of course, is never a bad reason to look at anything. And for our second selection this evening, we're also going to look at the first episode of the cartoon series Tales from the Crypt Keeper, called While the Cat's Away. But obviously, just to come back to your site, I mean, if people aren't familiar with either Flight Tights and Movie Nights or Channel Supero, what's the site really about for those not in the know?
Well, it's pretty much getting to the point where if any comic book or superhero has been adapted to something live action or animation, then I am aware of it and have plans to have writing on it at some point in the future. It's flightsitesandmovienights.com is the site that I've been working on the longest, going on about 4 years now. and I've covered almost 300 superhero and comic book related movies. And then just last January, I started channelsuperhero.com just because we're kind of in a boom of superhero TV shows and comic book TV shows. Like, it started with just Arrow and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and then about another half dozen started this last fall season, and then it's like there's another half a dozen starting this fall season, and like only one of last year's got canceled, so there's like 20 shows on the air that's all about superheroes and comic books.
Yeah. And ironic that the one that got canceled, Constantine, was one of the better ones.
Yeah. But it was also one of the ones with the lowest ratings. I mean, it got comparable ratings to Flash and Arrow, but the fact that it was on NBC, which they expected much higher ratings than that, so it got the axe.
Okay. I mean, obviously, something I do obviously have to question is that what's your gripe with Gotham?
Well, it's just ridiculous in so many places. I mean, it's the whole concept of the show is a difficult one to figure out, because it almost looks at Jim Commissioner Gordon, or soon to be Commissioner Gordon, as if he was Batman, except you know that in the end he's going to fail. Because whenever Batman comes in, Gotham is still this cesspool. And so he's like fighting a losing battle. And like half the characters are just so ridiculously over the top and hammy. And other ones are so completely understated. And it's just really difficult to know what tone the show is going for.
Personally think it's one of the best comic book shows out there. I think mainly because it doesn't look like a GQ explosion every time I watch an episode, such as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., probably one of the most overrated shows in the current comic book cycle. I mean, Lucky, what's your sort of thoughts on the comic book sort of cycle for TV?
I have not really actually seen any of the big superhero / comic book ones. I did make a shot at the earlier on in the year, take a shot at the pilot for is it Agent Carter, the spinoff of the Captain America movies, and that actually looked pretty good, and that was I really like, I think her name's Hayley Atwell,
yes,
but I never got back to that for whatever reason, and I've been meaning to.
That's a good one, and it's only 8 episodes, so.
Right, and I know that did not do very well in the ratings, and they were expecting it to be canceled, but I guess it got picked up for a second season. And what I saw of that, I really liked. I kind of really liked that almost noirish type feel to it, the period feel. But just things kind of got away from me, and I never returned to it. I've heard some good things about Arrow and the Flash. Gotham, what I'm hearing about from people about Gotham is almost kind of a mix of what the two of you are saying. People are saying it's basically completely insane, but that's why a lot of people love it. It is so over the top, and that seems to be a lot of its appeal. I am looking forward to the Jessica Jones show, which should be debuting on Netflix next month, but that's because of my Doctor Who fandom, with David Tennant being the villain.
Yeah, that's an unusual one. I'm not sure if he's going to work as a villain. I certainly love the lead actress who is going to be playing Jessica Jones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've been a fan of Kristen Ritter ever since Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know, like, I hadn't heard of her, but then, like, just I think sometime last year, my wife just started deciding to watch Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, and I fell in love with that show.
That show got cancelled, and it should never have got cancelled. I think the show was great just for the fact that you have James Vanderbeek playing James Vanderbeek.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's another of those actresses who it's nice to see her finally getting a lead role. She's always played like the interesting sort of side characters and stuff, such as appearance on Breaking Bad, and she's obviously, I think it was season two she was in, and then she sort of like got killed off there.
Yeah, and I think she played a sidekick on Veronica Mars for a while.
Yeah. And I also find it interesting that I haven't heard a ton about it, but like one of the few things I have heard is that this is going to be like the most extreme as far as the sexual side of things in the Marvel Universe.
Okay.
That there is supposed to be like this extremely racy sex scene between her and Luke Cage, I believe. And so they're really pushing the envelope on that side. On that side, that's Marvel really hasn't done before.
Yeah, I mean, in that respect, I think. Do you think it's for the better that it's been picked up by Netflix, that they're doing this like little series, with obviously going to bring them all together at the end? Do you think it's been for the best that Netflix have obviously decided to do these little mini series?
Yeah, I think it's like a nice little direction, just. Like them almost testing the waters, and the fact that Daredevil was so successful that they're like just jumping into it with both feet, and it gives them an excuse to try something that is a little bit more closer to being R-rated than the movie side of things.
Yeah. And obviously Daredevil's going on to get its second season now, which I can't help but feel has kind of broken the original mold. I thought that Daredevil would just have the one season, and then we would obviously go into Jessica Jones, but now we're talking about Daredevil season two.
Yeah, and I'm not even exactly sure like what the release timeline is going to be, because obviously Luke Cage is being introduced in the Jessica Jones series.
Yeah.
But it seems like Daredevil season two will be next up on the slate. And although I think that Luke Cage is following close behind that one. Like maybe Daredevil season two will again be like spring of next year, and then Luke Cage will be fall in the next year, like around where Jessica Jones is this year.
And
it's tough to say because yeah. They really keep things close to the belt. I mean, they only released the full length trailer for Jessica Jones just 1 month before the series goes up.
Yeah. And obviously this is our fourth stab now at the Punisher. Do you think that the fourth time's going to be the charm, or have we seen a decent Punisher yet?
Well, I'm still a fan of the Thomas Jane version, and I know that there's some people that enjoy the Warzone version. I'm sure this will be another one where some people will like it, some people maybe won't, but it's tough to say. And I think most people do agree that the Punisher works best as a side character within somebody else's story. So I think that it has the potential of being a really good version of the Punisher.
Yeah. I mean, like, have you had a favorite Punisher yet, or?
You know, I haven't. I have not actually seen the Punisher movies, although I have even known people who swore by the Dolph Lundgren version. Not many people, but they are out there. And I'm a little bit of an agnostic on the Punisher.
Yeah, because Warzone's really sort of come into vogue the last couple of years. It was panned when it was released, and now it's, I think, really since Patton Oswalt got behind it, it's suddenly come back into vogue. A lot of people really sort of loving its over-top style, and now obviously we're on the fourth attempt to try and translate this character. And as you said, Bob, we maybe will work better as a side character. I'm still a bit iffy on the actor they've got playing the Punisher this time. I think he's a little scrawny, a little too clean-cut for my taste.
Who,
to be Punisher.
Who have they got?
They got the guy who was
John Barathol, I think his name is.
Yeah, he was in Wolf of Wall Street.
That name does not sound familiar.
Okay. Did you watch Wolf of Wall Street?
I have not.
Okay. Yeah, I can't think of anything else. I know he's been in other things. I think he's been in a bunch of Greg Araki movies or something like that, but I really can't sort of place him. But he's got one of those faces that when you see him, it's like, oh, it's that guy. So I'd be interested to obviously see how he does it. I mean, I kind of wanted to see Ben Foster take on the role. I think after seeing him in Alpha Dog especially, I think he would have been really interested in the role. And I think the last thing I really saw him in was when he was playing Angel in X-Men The Last Stand. So
Ben Foster, yeah, he would make an interesting Punisher.
And it was really interesting with him because he was like, when he was first sort of introduced, when he broke out, it was like on 6 Feet Under, it was like the nerdy boyfriend. And then suddenly in Alpha Dog, he's like kicking everyone's ass. And he's been pretty much doing that ever since. Whether like it's in Hostage or if it's in X-Men or The Mechanic, it's really interesting that he suddenly switched from the nerdy guy to like the tough guy role. And I think he would be a really great Punisher, but obviously they've cast the guy they have. And I sort of waits to be seen on whether he can pull it off. I mean, do you think he's got what it takes, Bob Wade?
Well, I mean, he was in one of the Punisher movies.
Which one was he in?
He was in the Thomas Jane version. He played Dave, the guy with all the piercings, one of the goofy neighbors.
See, what I remember from the original one, obviously, other than the fact he was like ripping off Mad Max, is the fact that Kevin Nash made such an awesome Russian, and they had this like middle section where he just seemed to be fighting random villains, just like. These villains would just like turn up and they'd have like no purpose whatsoever.
Yeah, but I mean, I always love that song that Harry Heck plays. In fact, I just watched the extended version just a few days ago.
Does it add to it at all? I remember it not being particularly great, so.
No, I think I still prefer the theatrical version over the extended version. Like, nearly all of the scenes in the extended version revolve around an additional character that had just like a very brief scene in the theatrical version. You find out that he was the guy that basically gave Frank Castle's name up to Howard Saint.
Oh, okay.
And so he has a scene where Howard Saint basically gets the name from him. And then he has scenes with him talking with Frank Castle after he's come back, where Frank Castle like figures out that he's the one that sold him out. And then he has a final scene where the Punisher basically punishes him.
Obviously, well, the last thing I want to just obviously open up to the group here. What's our feelings on the DC cinematic universe? Do we think that this is sort of like them attempting to play catch up with the Marvel cinematic universe, or does the prospect of Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice look as if it's got enough legs to sort of really establish the DC universe finally?
I don't know. I just got fed up with Batman in the cinematic sense, really, with the Dark Knight, the Christopher Nolan one, and it's been very difficult for me to really muster much in the way of enthusiasm for either Dawn of Justice or Suicide Squad. It's just, I don't know what it is, but it looks like it's just, I don't know.
Fair enough.
For me, I think it's really tough to say at this point because all we've seen is the trailers. And I know, like, the trailers for Man of Steel was a lot different than what we got. So I'm just at a point where I think we need to wait and see. I think it's an interesting direction that DC is taking versus Marvel. I do like that it's almost like they're two sides of the same coin. I think there is room for different takes on comic book properties. And if DC is different enough from Marvel, but is still good in their own way, I think that there's definitely room for both of them out there. I think Suicide Squad will really be the defining factor just as much as Batman versus Superman.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the kids pestering their parents for Suicide Squad toys. Like you go to Toys R Us and it's like, oh, well, Suicide Squad. And it's like, the name is risky enough, but the fact is, you know, they're going to like try and market this to kids. It's like, yeah, have the psychotic girlfriend of the serial killer, the Joker.
Yeah. And I really do think that just having this, I think a lot of people will be surprised at how popular Harley Quinn actually is.
Yeah.
Because, like, she's kind of discounted for a lot of comic book fans, but she's kind of snuck up and is really, like, one of the top five most well-known comic book or female comic book characters. It's Wonder Woman, Catwoman, Harley Quinn.
She's really, I think, gradually snuck up on popular culture. I was a little bit actually surprised at how much screen time she got in the Suicide Squad trailer. I think she even got more screen time than Will Smith, considering that she's essentially being played by, the first time I ever heard of Margot Robbie was in relation to her casting in Suicide Squad. I know she had been in a couple of other things before that, but she really has as a character kind of snuck up, and particularly the route that she took, that she was actually created for the DC animated shows in the mid-90s, and then became canonical later on in the comic books. That's really interesting. But yeah, they're going to have some, I can totally see like a Hot Topic, merchandising deal going on there, because her costume, and I've been making the constant complaint that all of her costume in the Suicide Squad trailer looks like it was all bought off the rack at Hot Topic.
Yeah.
And obviously just one final question I obviously have to ask, with obviously so many comic book properties being turned into either films or TV series. Is there any sort of comic properties that we would like, either like mainstream comics like DC and Marvel, or like the indie properties, things like Hack Slash and Why the Last Man, that we would like to see turned into either a TV show or a film series?
Well, for me, I'm not really up to date on a lot of the indie stuff. I know that there is quite a few of the slightly lesser known comic series that are in development, like Preacher is going to be on AMC. Let's see, Why the Last Man it's been in talks. It's been in development hell for a couple years at least. And
they have been making progress on that one, I've heard, though.
Yeah. I feel for a while that Why the Last Man on Earth was actually the sitcom The Last Man on Earth, but apparently it isn't. I was like, oh, this is what the comic book's about. And of course, I never read the comic book, so I've been watching it. And it's only like recently, it's like, no, dude, that's like something completely different.
Yeah, and there's also, what was it? Wynonna Earp is in development as well. That's also another like lesser known comic. Yeah.
Sandman's in development. His appearance in the post credit scene in Guardians of the Galaxy is really making me hopeful for a proper Howard the Duck movie. I am a ridiculous fan, unironically and unabashedly, of the mid-70s version of the character, Steve Gerber's run from about 74 to 78, is actually like one of my urtexts of how I actually look philosophically at the world.
I've heard that the new comic series, they brought him back, has been really well written as well.
Yeah, I'm a bit skeptical about anything. I got to take a look at that. I'm a bit skeptical about anything with the character non-Steve Gerber, but I mean, depending on who they've got writing it, it could be pretty good. But,
yeah, I listened to a handful of other like superhero movie podcasts, and one of them, it's two comic book fans and one who is really only experienced with the movies, and they have a movie episode, and then each of the two guys recommends some comic book runs to, like, if he liked the movie, to continue on and get him into the comics. And they did Howard the Duck, and he was recommended the first few issues of the recent run. Mm-hmm. As well as like the first few issues of the Gerber run.
Right.
I know for myself, I would love to see Umbrella Academy, something done with that. Joe Way's debut comic. I thought that was absolutely fantastic.
And you mentioning that, I know it's, I'm sure that it's not related at all, but I'm really curious because both DC and Marvel both have in development like a very similar property. Like one is like the damage control. They're both like the in development is like office comedies of the non-superpowered people that have to clean up after the all the damage and destruction from the fights.
I remember the first, this is dating me, I remember the original Damage Control miniseries from the 80s. So that just hearing that name again is a blast from the past.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so hard because there's so many, you think even the most obscure comic books is now seems to be getting picked up. I mean, I heard the rumor that they're attempting to make The Boys into a TV series over AMC.
Seriously?
And anyone who's read The Boys will know that the only way they're going to be able to bring it to the screen is by editing the hell out of it. Because it is not only ultra-violent, it's sexist as hell. There's scenes of rape and gratuitous sex in it. I mean, I thought The Preacher was going to be tough, but apparently the same team are also trying to do The Boys. Which, if they do, I really want them to cast Simon Pegg in it.
Oh, God.
But yeah, and I've heard Fables is also in development somewhere as well, which would be another great one to see. And 100 Bullets is also in development somewhere. It seems that every studio or TV production company wants to have the little slice of the comic book property. And it's now getting to the point where all the major ones are sort of tied up in, like, obviously Marvel's tied up over at Disney now. DC, are they with any studio in particular or?
Warner's. Are well, they owned by Warners?
Which obviously leaves a lot of these indie properties sort of open to be picked up. And obviously Hackslash, a comic series that only ran for 100 issues about the slasher hunters, I think would be really great to see. But I would like to see someone like HBO pick it up and do something like they did with the original Spawn cartoon series. And do like a little real edgy animation. I think with the popularity of Adult Swim and certainly if Rick and Morty can be as popular as it is, I certainly think that an adult cartoon show of like something like Hackslash could certainly get picked up. So
the other one I'd like to see, they did a pilot for it back in the mid double aughts that never came to anything, but Warren Ellis's Global Transmission, I think that would make a very good series. Particularly now with the X-Files revival. If the X-Files revival does well, Global Frequency has a very, very similar kind of remit. And I was really, really sad when I heard that the pilot for that one fell through. But I would like to see somebody try to take it up again.
Got any other sort of comic book things that they would like to see at all? Or have we pretty much covered them all now?
Archie versus Predator. That needs to be made into a movie.
What is it with Archie and just cramming him with random characters?
I heard that they have Riverdale in development.
How would you even do Archie as a series?
I don't know. I think it's supposed to be like a teen drama, like a teen comedy drama.
But Archie's not. It's something that I've only really encountered when I was over in the States because I don't think it has any sort of foothold over here in the UK. I think it's I don't know. It's too sort of 1950s Americana for us, which surprises me that it's not been more popular because obviously that whole greaser thing still refusing to die over here. So it surprised me that Archie hasn't had more of a foot in over here. So
yeah, and I've also heard that like they've recently revamped the writing and art in it, and they actually like it's getting a lot of critical praise. Like they almost like rebooted it and modernized it, and it's I've heard that it's excellent.
And I had heard that they'd rebooted, and I've seen getting quite a bit of critical acclaim is also the rebooted Sabrina.
I hadn't heard about that one. Yeah.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch, that's from, I think, the same stable of comic books.
Yes, it is.
I used to love that show.
There was actually like three different shows. There was like the old cartoon they originally did in like the 80s, the Hanna-Barbera. Or I don't think it was Hanna-Barbera, maybe Filmation. And then, of course, the Melissa Joan Hart series. And then they did a cartoon with Melissa Joan Hart as the voice.
I thought it was her sister who did the voice in the cartoon that followed.
It might have been her sister, but it was like all the same. It was very similar writing, I think.
Yeah. Oh, Melissa Joan Hart, my teenage crush. That's pretty much my childhood in the 90s, watching that and Clarissa Explains It All. So stay tuned next week where we just look at just copious amounts of Clarissa Explains It All. We're episodes now as a result, above a week when on the show. So, but obviously onto our chosen subject this evening. We're obviously talking about Tales from the Crypt. What is it about the show that made you want to do a blogathon about it?
Well, I've always loved the show. I discovered it it probably would have been maybe early to mid 90s where they started showing the reruns of the first few seasons on Fox, like late at night. I think like 11 o'clock on Saturday nights, something like that. I had a TV. I was one of those lucky kids. I had a TV in my room and we had cable. And I remember, like, it's kind of funny because, like, I have two older sisters and they're like 10 years older. So I, like, inherited their bunk beds, but it was just me. So it's like I would sleep on the bottom bunk and then I had the TV right there next to the bed. And like at that age, having bunk beds is like 3/4 of a fort ready made. And I had a TV in my fort, in my blanket fort. But yeah, I would like stay up late and watch like Tales from the Crypt and Mystery Science Theater 3000 and like late night Cartoon Network. They would do like the Saturday anime like once a year or something like that around Halloween, where I first saw Vampire Hunter D and Robot Carnival. But I was surprised that I just recently found out, because I didn't know this before, but whenever they shot Tales from the Crypt, they actually made it, and they made two versions of it. They shot the TV version. They shot and dubbed the TV or the network version, the syndicated version, at the same time as they were doing the HBO version. So they shot like the tamer scenes and without nudity so that it was ready to go for another network. But yeah, I just love the humor. I love the twists. Like I always love that, like ironic twist endings.
Obviously for myself in the UK, it was sort of like late night TV show for her. It didn't seem to ever get picked up. I mean, Lackey, what's your sort of experiences with the show? I think I'm right in saying you were a fan before, is that right?
I don't know if I'd say I was a fan. It was not a show that I was really heavily into, but I did watch a few episodes here and there. I'm familiar enough with it. I even remember, I'm old enough actually to remember when it actually first debuted on HBO back in, I think, 89. And I don't know if I watched it on day one, but I do seem to recall that I was watching a few episodes here and there as early as that. It's something that I was never really opposed to on the one hand, but on the other hand, I never really became a gigantic fan. It's a sort of, particularly the episodes I'm more familiar with, tend to be on a little bit on the campier side, which is, it's perfectly fine, but I'm not always as into that.
Yeah. And the actual casting of the show is absolutely incredible. If you go through like the episode guide and you see some of the guest stars that they have on, it's really a who's who of people that's on it. I'm not sure they were like at the point they just hadn't got their fame and stuff, and or whether it was just the appeal of the show that obviously drew them in. But certainly there's a lot of British actors on here. I mean, Tim Curry's in one. We've got Tim Roth in another. it seems basically if you any actor that you can think of has put an appearance in at one point in the show. I think even Daniel Craig shows up in one episode.
Yeah, Steve Coogan shows course, up.
and of course, in the seventh season, they actually moved production to the UK. And a lot of people thought that it was for budget reasons, but from what I read, it was because they had practically used up everybody that was interested in LA. So they're like, well, we need to move to someplace else to keep it fresh. So they decided to move it to the UK just to have like a bunch of fresh actors and directors just to give it a different look and feel.
I think the production team also had quite a bit to do with the cast, that it was co-produced by, amongst other people, Robert Zemeckis and David Giler and Walter Hill, who are probably best known as a production team for producing the Alien movies, but they also, Walter Hill's a fairly well-regarded director. He's the guy that directed The Warriors, Streets of Fire, 48 Hours. And between those three, you have a lot of Hollywood contacts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a ton of like famous, well-known horror directors and other writers and directors, and I always found it fascinating that for some reason it seems like in the middle seasons they would let well-known actors try their hand at directing an episode, and for a lot of them that's like their only directing credit, like. Famously, Arnold Schwarzenegger directed an episode, and Michael J. Fox directed an episode, and Tom Hanks, and Kyle MacLachlan, and that's like his only directing credit.
Kyle MacLachlan, the Billy Jack guy?
Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, Kyle MacLachlan, okay.
Yeah, the Twin Peaks guy.
Yeah, Tom Hanks did one. It's an interesting... somebody named Steve Perry directed one. No, it's not the guy from Journey. Okay.
Although the guy from The Who was in one of the episodes in the fifth season.
Roger Daltrey.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Roger Daltrey's acting career? Because he went for this whole period where he was like suddenly becoming an actor, and then he sort of like dropped off the radar. He just sort of like ran the early 90s. At one point, you sort of like everywhere, and he was becoming more well known to some people, obviously non Who fans, as being an actor and this Cockney guy.
I even remember he had like a semi regular role. He'd show up two or three times a season on Highlander.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah, and I thought that he was I recently watched just this past month his episode Forever Ambergris, and he was excellent in that episode.
Obviously, the episode which we have chosen out of all the seasons is the episode Comes the Dawn. The episode itself follows Colonel Parker and Sergeant Burroughs, who are two ex-soldiers with a questionable past, and they're heading into the Alaskan wilderness to do some illegal hunting, and along the way they bring along the local girl known as Jerry Dumbeater to act as their scout and guide to the local area. However, the unknown to these two soldiers, they're going to be made to face up to the consequences of their past actions. And this is a bit of a strange episode. I went into it and I kind of picked it just based on the 30 Days of Night vibe, the tale of vampires in the Alaskan wilderness, obviously taking advantage of the long days of night, in that particular case, the title of 30 Days. What we get instead is something quite different. Yes, there are vampires in this story, but it's more of a, how would you say, it's more of a tale of revenge, would you say? I mean, what's everyone's opening thoughts on this one?
And I, this is the sort of story you got quite a bit in the original Tales from the Crypt comic, where it is kind of like a sort of moral tale in which someone, a nasty person, gets his comeuppance.
Yeah, and I noticed that, and as far as my overall experience with Tales from the Crypt, like I've mostly familiar with like the first four seasons, which I went through them again last year for kind of my own mini blogathon, where it was just me participating. And I went through all of the first four seasons, but I noticed that I'm a lot less familiar and haven't seen a lot of the of seasons 5, 6, and 7. And I believe this was the first time that I've seen this one. I didn't remember this one at all. And I noticed that this one was a lot more serious. Like, there isn't a whole lot of campiness to this episode, aside from, of course, like the Crypt Keeper's intro and outro.
Yeah, I just want to obviously talk about the Crypt Keeper. He's got these, with every episode, and this was carried over to the Kaiju series as well, he does these schlocky openings, which for myself are the real highlights of the episode, to see what he's doing this week. I mean, obviously on this one, he's on a beach randomly for a tale which is set in the Alaskan wilderness. I'm not too sure why. For the episode I covered for the blog from the pit, he's celebrating Christmas for an episode which is about mixed martial arts. I often got the feeling that these intros and outros didn't really, they seem to be separate to the actual, what was happening in the episode themselves. I mean, what's your guys' feelings on the actual Crypt Keeper as host?
Like, I love him. And I think at least in this one, I have no idea about the Christmas one for the pit. That one, it sounds really weird unless like maybe it aired right around Christmas. So that's where that connection was. But this one, I kind of thought that it was like the juxtaposition and the fact that he's on the beach while the story he's telling is in Alaska. I thought that kind of explained that part of it. But it's just, and I mean, in a way, it is that juxtaposition. You have this, he's like this rotting corpse, almost literally. But he's telling these jokey puns, and it's just this silly intro and outro whenever you're the actual meat of the story is usually like this darker horror.
Yeah.
Interesting thing actually about the third pig is he actually narrates it, and the Crypt Keeper actually narrates the episode, and he has a lot of, there's a lot of fourth wall breaking between him and the big bad wolf, because the big bad wolf resents the fact he constantly has to speak in rhyme when the Crypt Keeper doesn't, which was actually one of the funnier things. For me, it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's not a style of... I mean, when you get something that's really kind of ups the irony and really plays off the irony and absurdity, like with Comes the Dawn, you know, where he's hanging around and it's this whole Charles Atlas scenario where he goes and gets revenge on somebody who kicks sand in his face, and he's, you know, hanging around with a girl in a revealing bikini. I thought that was, the absurdity there was, I thought, rather interesting, but it's not, for the most part, a style of humor. The strained puns, it's not a style of humor that I'm really a fan of, and I don't know if I'd say a love-hate relationship with John Kassir's performance, but with his voice performance, but that's something I kind of have to be in the mood for. If I'm not, it really kind of grates on me. But yeah. it's another callback to the original Tales from the Crypt comic, the EC horror comic. So it certainly obviously belongs there.
It, for myself, I always found the Crypt Keeper like a throwback to the sort of like horror boom movie hosts that you had on cable TV, people like Elvira, and that, who just used to make little, sort of like schlocky puns and on the film, or had these like tedious tie-ins. So I kind of like it, and it's weird often that you have an episode which is played essentially very straight as this one, and then you've obviously got this sort of jokey opening and close to it. It really gives it a weird sort of tone. I mean, with this episode, I mean, for myself, I find it very sort of off-putting. The episodes are only around 30 minutes each. I kind of wanted this one to be longer, like a 45-minute, like a proper episode length. like a little mini TV movie, such as like you had with the Masters of Horror. I felt that it would have benefited this. And for myself, this episode, it kind of was over and done with rather quickly. We spent most of the episode getting to the sort of shack, and then it was sort of over and done with very quickly. I mean, what do you guys think on the actual sort of runtime, and would it have benefited from being longer?
I think it would have. I agree with you that it spends so much of the episode trying to get where it needs to be that the actual resolution seems to be a bit rushed. This is, I think, a kind of a period where we're moving away. In general, we're moving away from the traditional anthology show format into longer stories. And I think definitely this one would have benefited from a 45-minute or an hour runtime.
Something else that also got me with the ending. The assistant character, Parker, played by Bruce Payne, he gets a bear trap on his foot, yet manages to stagger all the way back to the the bar. I don't know, did anyone else find that?
It was her house, but yeah.
That's one of the places where the low budget really showed of the episode, that you only have these three locations. And I really kind of felt that it needed actually more outdoor work.
Yeah.
There were bits that need to take place outside, and instead it's just basically three. And I don't think they really did a good job with the third act, which takes place in the remote installation. I don't really think they did a good job of scale of that at all, where they make where you would feel like this is some place, some deserted thing in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Although I did like the multiple fake outs, like the almost like the twists. Like whenever she is trying to double cross Michael Ironside's character, and then you think that he's going to turn traitor on him. And then he's like, "What do you think, Corporal?" And then the camera cuts over, and you see that he's been listening to them the whole time. And then, like later on, whenever they reveal the vampires, and he says kind of the similar things, where you think that he's going to turn on I guess she's like a zombie. She had come back to life. Yeah, they don't really explain her. Like she mentions that she's undead as well, but she's not a vampire, and the vampires can't feed on her because she is a different type of undead. But you think that the other guy is going to turn on her again, but at the last second he turns on Michael Ironside and shoots him to try and get away.
Which was really interesting because the episode set you up to look at Michael Ironside as being the big villain of the piece.
Yeah.
And it disposes of him, not really quickly, but the rest of it. There's a goodish amount of the episode is dedicated to the fallout from that and the Bruce Payne character, the sergeant, and Jerry's pursuit of him.
I mean, do you think that's more the fact it's Michael Ironside that we instantly assume something's afoot with him? Or is it more down to his performance, though? I mean, when I see him, I just assume that Michael Ironside's up to no good because it's Michael Ironside.
I thought that the way the episode was structured and edited really put a lot of focus on him. Really, Bruce Payne doesn't really do or say a whole... I mean, he does things. He kills the bartender. He does things here and there. But really, he doesn't take the focus until Michael Ironside decides out of somewhat nowhere, he's just going to go and search the perimeter. And these two have to stay back, which is kind of a weird thing. And you know something's up there, which is why I was not entirely convinced that the sergeant was going to sell him out at that point.
And I also find it interesting on a completely different level that this is actually the second episode that Michael Ironside did for Tales from the Crypt. He did another episode back in season 2 called The Sacrifice, where he did play the villain in that one, pretty much.
I think this is the thing with Michael Ironside. He's, for his body of work, he has been sort of renowned as being a villainous sort of character. I think only occasionally, such as like Starship Troopers, as he played someone sort of slightly heroic, so he comes with this sort of aura around him.
Yeah, or he plays a morally ambiguous character, like in V. That's, I think, the thing a lot of people, at least in the States, associate him as Hamilton, Ham Tyler, I think his name was.
Obviously, vampires are the big evil for this episode. What do we think of the vampire effects? I thought they were very reminiscent of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Although this actually, I think this episode actually predates From Dusk Till Dawn by a year or so. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of like your classic monstrous vampire, not entirely full Nosferatu type, but your more monstrous style.
Mm-hmm. Something along the lines of, like, not quite Buffy the Vampire Slayer with the bumpy foreheads, but somewhere in between, and not exactly the 30 Days of Night either.
It kind of suited, obviously, with this being the wilderness, you would expect a more sort of feral sort of vampire. So I really liked the fact it sort of fitted in more with the location than if they just turned out to be... I mean, the 30 Days of Night style could have still worked, but if they just turned up and been sort of like traditional eye-rolling sort of generic vampire, I don't think it would have worked as well, like if they were like a vampire Eskimo or something, so...
Vampire Eskimo!
It was also... It wasn't really explained too much what those cocoons were either, because whenever he finds like the vampire den, they're in these hanging like mucus cocoons.
Yeah.
And it's hard to tell if maybe those were like, if it's just entering the Alaskan winter, where they're just like, it's at the beginning of the 30 days a night, even though that she says that it's 2 months before sunrise. So I don't know exactly what location they're in or exactly how that works, but maybe they were like hibernating there for the summer and they were just coming out for the winter.
Yeah.
Or if like my first thought was that they were like new vampires and they had just been turned, but I don't think that really holds up based on what little we find out throughout the episode.
I thought that there was something that they might... My feeling was that she might have been, and this is kind of weird, because she clearly had some sort of history there. The fact that she says in Alaska, the night lasts 2 months, when that's kind of like a vague generality. It's not in all of Alaska. It's just in specific areas when you get further north. That was just one of those... I don't know, just like little things that stuck. It probably doesn't mean anything, but it just stuck in my mind.
I think one of the other things that got me about the story is just the fact that you have this tale of revenge, where obviously Jerry Jumbie is wanting to get revenge on these two soldiers, but the fact that she randomly turns up in the same place they're planning to go hunting, I mean, is it a little too much coincidence, or was there something else at play that would obviously have led them to be in this location, so she could essentially have her revenge?
Something, I got the distinct feeling that the colonel knew she was here and came here specifically looking for her. That was the feeling I got. I don't know if there's anything specific that I could, in the dialogue, that could put my, I could put my finger on. He didn't seem surprised he didn't seem surprised at all like that. And there were just a couple of other things in his demeanor that made me think I don't know whether the sergeant knew, but he knew specifically and was looking to get revenge. The whole thing, I feel, was like a setup to get, because he thought, I was thinking maybe he thought that she knew that he had specifically called that friendly fire attack and was looking, he wasn't looking to get a hunt bears. He was looking specifically for her.
Yeah, I didn't really get that at all. I kind of thought, felt a little bit of that surprise because we haven't talked about that aspect, because which is almost like another twist, because the two guys first show up in this like this Alaskan bar where it's just the vampire, and they're talking about hunting bears, and she says that sounds like my ex Jerry, and so just based on normal. Like normal culture, you expect Jerry to be a guy's name, and then they show up at this person's house and you find out that Jerry is a woman.
Well, she even refers to Jerry as a him when she says she turned Jerry in. She says, I think she said, I turned him in, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I think she does. It's one of those things, because obviously you have this, I don't know, can it be described as a cautionary tale? Because essentially the reason that they are being punished is because he made a call to more to his own men, technically, in the field of combat. So can it really be described as a cautionary tale? Because it's not like he essentially wronged him. He made a call on a field of battle. So this is what so through me is like, yes, I obviously understand the fact that why Jerry would be upset and being mortared, but it's just, it was such a weird way that she would obviously choose to get revenge, and just the fact that it would have to be in Alaska and involve these vampires that are there for no discernible reason, because it's not like there's a huge population in this town. We only have essentially the barmaid, and she's a vampire as well. And obviously Jerry's, I guess we're saying the zombie now. It was just a weird how it all sort of came together. I like the twist. It just, obviously when I try to examine it further, it sort of falls apart more for myself.
I think to go back to your original criticism, I think it needs more time to develop its story. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing. I would have liked, again, this is something that's entirely out of the scope of the budget, but I would have liked to have started with a flashback to Desert Shield or Desert Storm or whatever conflict. I would have liked something. I would have liked a little bit more context to just simply have this character and simply be told about him. Oh, he did this, and not really have a whole lot of visual context in terms of what we see story-wise. We know he's not, he's kind of like a typical, you know, American military asshole, you know, barking orders and playing the alpha male. But I think we really kind of needed a little bit more context. And I think that's where the 25-minute running time kind of works against the effectiveness.
Has anyone got any sort of other points they want to raise on this one before we wrap it up?
The last thing I kind of want to mention is that you did mention a couple of times that this is kind of like a darker and more muted as far as the story goes, but I did kind of feel that Michael Ironside and Bruce Payne did kind of play their characters a bit over the top. Mind you, that's what Michael Ironside does most memorably. I'm not sure anybody really wants to see Michael Ironside play things muted or subtle.
He sort of has this one sort of style of acting, which is just Michael Ironside playing Michael Ironside.
Yeah.
I think every role he plays is essentially the same. It's sort of sneering smiles and just presence. He's one of these actors who has a certain amount of presence without even trying. Whenever he's on the screen, he's just like very magnetic, and you're just sort of drawn to him, even if he's not doing particularly nice things. You can't help but be fascinated by the character he's playing. And even now, with films like Turbo Kid and stuff, he's still essentially giving us the same performance, but it's still fascinating to watch.
There was one point, when he first appeared, and he's taking the scarf, he's completely buried under the scarf, and he starts to unravel it, and it's like the minute you see his eyes, it's like, that's Michael Ironside. I don't think there are many actors I could entirely identify entirely on that basis.
Yeah. But you got any final thoughts on this one?
No, not too much. Although I will say that it's one of those episodes where, like, just watching it, I did enjoy it for the most part, even though I agree that it doesn't really hold up whenever you start picking it apart very, very well. But I still think that it was a fun half-hour watch.
Yeah. But do many of these episodes actually hold up to being picked apart and that, or do they exist more as a ride to be taken and not to really be questioned and examined too closely?
It kind of comes and goes, because the Tales from the Crypt is one of those shows that really runs the gamut of horror, because they have some episodes that are literally almost entirely comedic with very little horror, like one episode which I like, even though it's not what I would consider typical Tales from the Crypt, and it's funny because it's the only episode that was actually written by William H. Gaines, and that's The Reluctant Vampire with Malcolm McDowell and the guy that plays Norm from Cheers.
George Wendt?
George Wendt, yes.
Yeah, George Wendt.
Mm-hmm. And that's like completely played for laughs. But it's still an enjoyable episode. And then there's other episodes that do hold up really well. Like the only actual two-part episode, Yellow, that's set in World War I, that is a fantastic episode. And that really, and that's also like the complete other end of the spectrum. There's not really much horror in that one, or any comedy at all. It's like almost a straight up drama, with the only horror being like the horrors of war. And that is really just an amazing episode.
And on that note, we're just going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll be looking at our second selection this evening. We'll be looking at the cartoon version of Tales from the Crypt, which was branded instead Tales from the Crypt Keeper. So as I said, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll be looking at the first episode of that season, While the Cat's Away.
If you like intelligent and smart movie discussion,
Base is a zombie movie.
How did he write a book if he doesn't have an arm?
Or want to hear the latest news on your favorite actor?
Talk some Julianne Moore, I guess.
Whales have more films than Zoe Saldana.
Check out The Lambcast, where no question is too risque.
Rachel, do you have a mouth?
Check out The Lambcast, the official podcast of The Lamb, the large association of movie blogs, which can be found at largeassmovieblogs.blogspot.com. Si habla español.
Hola y bienvenido a la...
And we're back. Still joining us on the show this evening is Mr. Bubba Wee.
Yeah, still here.
Obviously, in our first half of the show, we looked at an episode of Tales from the Crypt. Now we're obviously moving on to the cartoon series, which it randomly spawned. This was rebranded and known as Tales from the Crypt Keeper, but it still kept John Cassar as the Crypt Keeper, still doing his intros and outros. and giving
Tales
like,
from the Crypt!
Sorry.
And this was obviously back in 93, where sort of teen horror was a sort of boom. We had this show, we had Are You Afraid of the Dark? You had Goosebumps, you had like the Point Horror books. Horror was a really big thing back in the early 90s, and this show
like
was
teen
really
horror.
Yeah.
And I also want to point out, if I remember correctly, this was about the same time that more adult-oriented horror movies were spawning kid-focused cartoon shows. Like,
I want to say that the Toxic Avenger cartoon also started around this time.
Yeah, the Toxic Crusaders.
The Toxic Crusaders, and I want to say there was a Killer Tomatoes cartoon from about this time as well.
Yes, I watched all of those. I vaguely remember the Killer Tomatoes cartoon, and I love that. And I did watch Tales from the Crypt Keeper when it was a Saturday morning cartoon. I don't remember very many episodes of it, but I do distinctly remember watching it.
Yeah, because here in the UK, the cartoon series, ironically, was more popular than the actual TV show it was spawned from. And it's a weird idea to take essentially an adult TV show and make it for kids, because the original TV show had gore and violence, and it really wasn't sort of kid friendly.
And sex.
And the fact they thought, oh, well, that'd be a really great idea to like do a kid's version. And they somehow make it work somehow. And I think this was really one of the standout kids horror shows. This and Are You Afraid of the Dark were like the real standout ones. Mm-hmm. Again, these still were short episodes of 22 minutes. And this first episode, While the Cat's Away, the Crypt Keeper himself actually works himself into the story, as we'll obviously discuss in a bit. But, I mean, what's everyone's sort of opening thoughts on this one? I mean, this is a story where we've got two brothers planning to break and enter someone's house to steal money so they can buy a dirt bike.
Not just any dirt bike. The Baja Sandslicer P11.
Yeah, which it
allows. Man, they're making it sound like something I would break into somebody's house to steal money for that kind of thing. Then he has these like fantasies where he says "Hasta la vista, baby," and he rides around on the Baja Sandslicer P11. I mean, that's some amazing advertising they've got there.
He also rides into the sun.
So yes,
he can fly as well, apparently.
Hey.
Yeah, and I think it's funny too that the older brother is like so focused on that through 90% of the episode, he's still like, I know all this stuff is happening, but I'm still going to find that treasure so I can get that dirt bike.
Like I think roughly half of his dialogue in the second half of the episode is just him going, vroom, and making the revving, you know, gesture, revving the whatever that is, the handlebar. I guess there's probably a term for that. I'm going to stop now.
The throttle.
The throttle, yeah, that thing. You can tell I knew nothing about mopeds or scooters or anything.
But let's not forget the older brother is such a badass. He has girly tassels on his bike.
he's a whole whopping 11, and his name is Stu. Stu and Dwight. And I'm sitting here thinking, how many kids like their age in 1993 would have been named Stu and Dwight?
Yeah. It's odd, but obviously we got the two brothers. They're trying to obviously get money so they can get this dirt bike, and their father runs, while it's supposed to, I'm assuming it's supposed to be a classy sort of travel agency, but it seems kind of sleazy. I don't know if it's the character design, very John Waters-esque. And we've got this sort of stereotypical rich woman in the office, and she has, you obviously emphasize in the pearls, but why do the pearls have red flashes for sparkles?
They're blood pearls.
Blood pearls.
Yeah.
Kind of like blood diamonds.
And obviously through their father, they find out this house is going to be abandoned, and they go in, and right from the start, it's a stereotypical haunted house sort of look. I mean, would you have preferred something a little more normal looking, and then with the surprise of what's inside, or do you like the sort of haunted house sort of setup from the start?
Oh, hell no. No, this thing needs, this house needs to look like the haunted freaking mansion out of the Disney ride. I mean, having like a normal house at the end of the street, I don't think that would have worked for this.
No.
I think to go full balls out the entire way, you have to have, I think, a house that you can readily believe that in the basement there's a werewolf chained up in a bricked up wall. You know, it's got to be the sort of place where you look at it, you know, there's hidden passages and, you know, deep, dank, you know, labyrinthine cellars and stuff like that.
Yeah, and also this episode definitely feels like it was always intended to be the pilot episode for this cartoon, because that mansion feels like it is two kids sneaking into the Crypt Keeper's house, kind of like the opening sequence in the TV show.
Yeah, it's and the actual episode itself, it basically throws everything, including the kitchen sink, at these two kids. It's like any sort of horror cliche or memorable character, they wheel out. So we've obviously got the werewolf we mentioned. We've got a Frankenstein monster. We've got some weird octopus thing in a tank. And we've got vampires and zombies. The vampires in particular, I really... really stood out for me for the fact that they didn't bother to make them individual. They just traced and clones. Put the same vampire three
it's
times.
Vampire clones.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I'm pretty sure they're all based on Jack Palance's version of Dracula.
the Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah.
For you guys, I mean, did it become a little Scooby-Doo-esque when they sort of went into the sort of Frankenstein lab and it was sort of just felt like one thing after another?
Yeah, a little bit, especially whenever they're like... There's the scene where they're running, where they get split up and they're running through the corridors and they think that they're meeting each other, but instead they meet the wolf, the werewolf, and the Frankenstein's monster instead.
Yeah, it's and there's some real genuine threat, which also surprised me, especially for a kid's cartoon. There's moments where I did think like the older brother was going to like bite it, and there was also a point where they find the treasure and it's the comic book. You see the Tales from the Crypt comic book, and it's them surrounded by zombies. And I thought that was how the episode was going to end. It was going to end with them being zombie chow, but ultimately it sort of bulks at the sort of last minute. But
that led into my absolute favorite part of the episode, where the younger brother, Dwight, who's all of 8, goes on this epic rant about, oh, it's the number one issue. Hey, at least we didn't have to die for issue number 2.
I don't know if it's just obviously a period of the time. Obviously, this being early 90s, a lot of cartoons would get a lot darker. Hanna-Barbera's particular were doing a lot of dark cartoons, things like SWAT Cats. And we had the aforementioned Technicolor Tomatoes, Toxic Crusaders. I think even Swamp Thing was around this time. It may have been more sort of mid-90s. What do you think it was about the early 90s that suddenly we were taking these risks with, like, kids' cartoons to actually put out dark material?
Well, I think it really comes down to a certain extent, like the Batman, the animated series, and the X-Men cartoon series. I think that even those were more action cartoons. The fact that they were like the darker action, and they had the more serious issues in some of the episodes, maybe not in the early parts of the seasons, but I do think that those did like pave the way for them.
I would agree there. I also always have felt that the Tim Burton Batman movies kind of may have it created a new market for some of this, for some of these, like kids in their, you know, a little bit younger, not teenagers, but what we'd call tweens now, kids, you know, early adolescents, somewhere in the 12, 13, 14 age range, that, you know, having been getting into things like comic books and such like that from the Batman movies, were ready for something that was a little bit more sophisticated. The other couple things I'd say there was kind of like coming at popular culture from the other end was this kind of thing coming where a recognition that cartoons and animation wasn't necessarily just for, you know, young children anymore. This was when anime started to become a little bit more, not necessarily mainstream, but a little bit hipper. And you had things like on MTV, Liquid Television, which spawned Beavis and Butthead and Aeon Flux and a number of other things.
Oh, yeah. And I just remembered another popular cartoon for a slightly more grown-up movie Like Beetlejuice was really popular around this time too.
And
that also had like the horror elements in it.
And Ren and Stimpy, which wasn't necessarily horror, but had somewhat a more deliberately grotesque art style and a little bit more of a gross-out style of humor.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was, and that was something where Ren and Stimpy started on Nickelodeon over here and then moved to MTV because it started to get a fan base of the tradition of fans that were older than, you know, your traditional cartoon target audience.
So it's known as.
Yeah. this basically kind of like the same, you know, age range that a lot of the Adult Swim stuff goes, you know, 18-year-old stoners who were up in the middle of the night. You know, it's the same kind of, you know, it's the Adult Swim demographic. But I think it's a number of things kind of all converging at the same point.
And this is someone I've got to thank Bob Waite for, because you actually exposed your daughter to this episode. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. I watched it with my 8-year-old daughter.
Yeah, I'd really love to know what a modern kid made of an early 90s cartoon, because I find kids today, they're kind of snobby when it comes to trying to expose them to like early cartoons and stuff. So, I mean,
well,
did she pick up on it?
I mean, she's right here. What did you think about the Tales from the Crypt cartoon?
I thought it was okay.
It was okay? What was your favorite part of it?
The part when the kids ran away.
Any particular bit of running away, or just the running away in general?
Oh, she's gone.
she's run off as well, but... Okay, yeah. That was just a real moment on the show, but thank you for that, Bubby.
But yeah, she seemed to like it pretty well. I mean, she liked it enough that after we watched this one, they clicked over to another episode on YouTube, and I actually did like that one better. Like, it involved a kid that was making prank phone calls, and one of the prank phone calls he made was to this like old elderly woman, and she happened to know his name, and he got freaked out, and then she starts calling him like in every phone around him, and she like starts terrorizing him and sends him this Christmas card, and then he goes to her house, and then she like turns into this like witch ghost. And it's that one really feels a lot more like a moral lesson.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And it was also interesting to look at it, because it was like just the era that it was made. You could tell it was like just right on the cusp of cell phones, because there's like one moment, like the whole big thing is he's getting his own phone and his own phone line. But it's still like a wired phone in his room. But there's also one point where the person calls another teenager's cell phone. So it's like, it's interesting just because you can tell that it was made at a time where it's like just on the cusp of cell phones.
And I mean, does anyone think that this style of cartoon has got sort of potential to come back? I mean, obviously we've got the forthcoming film adaptation of Goosebumps. There's a lot
of
shows that...
And also, I do want to mention this, because, I guess if we watched the show earlier today, but last night we actually decided that we wanted to go out and see a movie, and all three of us, and the choice was between Gem and the Holograms and the Goosebumps movie. And it's like my wife and I were pushing for the Goosebumps movie, because I'd heard it's like people actually like that. and Jem, even though like we weren't against seeing it, like we thought that it had potential. Like my wife had watched some old Jem cartoons like in the past 6 or 8 months ago, so she had refamiliarized herself with that show, so she was kind of interested in what direction they took. But my daughter was like completely against seeing Goosebumps, because I guess she thought it would be too scary.
Okay.
But it's she's like on one of those weird lines where she likes a lot of the horror monsters. Like she likes whenever they're like girlified because she's a big fan of Monster High and things like that. But she's only afraid, or she only likes basically the non-scary monsters.
That's good. And Lucky, I mean, is any of these sort of shows you'd like to see get a revival at all?
I don't know. I think that there might very well be a market for something like this, because it does seem that the trend has been really over the last 25 years, but particularly recently, that animated series aimed at, you know, adolescents and tweens, it seems to be getting a lot more sophisticated in the storytelling. It's always a discussion like this. You always discuss things like Adventure Time, Steven Universe, Gravity Falls.
Our family as a whole is a huge fan of Steven Universe. It's one of those where my daughter loves it, and my wife and I love it just as much.
And even, you know, as silly as this may sound, even the fact that there is now, an adult fandom for something like Friendship is Magic, it does kind of show that the traditional demographic age lines are breaking down for animated series. I don't know if there's anything I could specifically say I'd like to see get a revival, but I think anything that exposes people, because I'm, of course, the guy that runs the Nominal Horror site, anything that kind of I definitely think that there's a market, and there's definitely a societal purpose for horror that is specifically marketed at a younger audience. It doesn't necessarily have to be as intense as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, obviously, but something like I can't think of any specific property I want to see in this off the top of my head, but I think the niche is there.
Yeah. I think these shows kind of provide that entry point into horror. This is sort of like the safe entry point to these sort of ideas and these characters. And then obviously as kids go, they discover like the universal monsters, and obviously then they're going to like the more splatter-heavy 80s and 70s sort of movies and that. So I think in that way, it's nice that they provide it. But even going back and looking at some of the things, certainly in terms of like the point horror and that, they were kind of really on the cusp of what they were doing. They were never sort of held back at all. I remember quite a few scenes in the old point horrors being quite shocking. And here I felt in this episode, it really kind of pushed it in a way that I don't think a modern TV show would be able to get away with.
Yeah.
It's not allowed to put kids in peril anymore.
Yeah.
Everything's got to be very sort of safe and sterile, and, you know, the dog's always got to survive.
Yeah, that was something where I was actually kind of surprised. Someone earlier, I think it was Bubba, mentioned that they thought that the episode was going to end, or his daughter thought it was going to end right when they found, you know, the comic book, and they were gonna, you know, they were gonna be zombie chow, and that's actually what I thought was gonna be the climax as well. Everything from that point on, that they run and escape, I was actually kind of surprised with.
Yeah.
Although I still think, and just for the record, it was Elwood that said that, but I still think that as a kid show, like I was fully expecting them to survive, even though shows had some darker elements around that time. But I still don't think that they would have been able to get away with something without having the kids survive at the end. Because I do think that this is that Tales from the Crypt Keeper as a whole, it did have these like horror-oriented shows, but at the end, each episode had this like a morality lesson. Like I only watched two episodes so this time around, so I only really have that to go off of. But I'm pretty sure that this followed in a lot of the other ones. That each episode, it's like the kid as the main character would do have some sort of transgression, and that's why they were put into this, like the Crypt Keeper would put them in this horror situation, and then they would eventually get out of it by learning what they were doing was wrong. And so that's kind of plays into the whole morality tale of it more than the actual Tales from the Crypt would do. Like in this one, they're being punished because they're trying to steal. And like in the other episode that I mentioned, the kid's being punished because he's making all these prank calls on his new phone.
I do have to say in my defense here, I think I knew before, you know, going into this, I think I knew that there was a Tales from the Crypt cartoon. I didn't really know a whole lot about it. I didn't know that it was a Saturday morning cartoon. So I was actually thinking that this, watching this, that this might have been something like syndicated that actually would have run in the afternoon, and therefore might have been able to get away with a little bit more.
I actually thought they had actually killed Stu off when he gets grabbed by the octopus. Because you see his shoes get pulled off, and I thought, oh, that's the end of Stu.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because it is such a quick cut. I think like the inside of his shoes, whenever he pulls them off, are red. So it almost looked like he pulled his feet off along with the shoes.
Yeah, you noticed that as well. I have to say, Dwight's got the worst aim I've ever seen. The monster's right in front of him. I'm assuming that he's trying to throw the vials and flasks at the monster, but they all seem to end up in the tank, which is to his left. And while we're on this, while I've driven us to this subject, how long are the kids in the house exactly? Because they go to the house because they overhear their father talking to someone and getting putting together a travel package for someone we learn to be the Crypt Keeper.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the episode, they pass the Crypt Keeper when they're running away, the Crypt Keeper who is coming home from his vacation.
Yeah, and I thought that was weird too, because it seemed like whenever he was talking about the vacation, that it was something that he wanted the guy to plan, as in he would be taking a vacation like in a few weeks or in a couple months' time. But then the kids act like he's gone now.
He's gone now and he's never coming back. It's an abandoned house, I think Stu calls it at one point. You know, and I'm like, what? Was he gone? He was gone like an hour.
It really surprised me.
Did he have a time machine?
When we came full circle and it's the Crypt Keeper, because obviously at the start, he's there discussing his options for taking this holiday, and you know, it's all the usual sort of ghoulish things. He's there like tied to an anchor and been dumped in sharks and stuff, and then we obviously get to the end of the episode and it's the Crypt Keeper's house, and I thought it'd be like they go inside the house and they'd be like they find like a vampire casket or something like that. I thought that would be the twist, not that we're going to throw every horror cliche we can at you.
And I think did either of you watch any more episodes or just the one?
I only watched the one.
I mean, I've seen other episodes, so I'm still pretty familiar with the series, but on this occasion, I just watched the one, so...
Yeah, because I was just wondering, because I don't remember if the Crypt Keeper does take an active role, a more active role in several of the episodes, because he did also play a more active role in the telephone episode. He plays, like, the telephone operator. He's dressed up in, like, the 50s telephone operator, and he's the one that connects him to the ghost that torments him. I couldn't remember if he does that in more episodes, like in every episode as well.
I'm not too sure if he does. Because certainly the ones I remember seeing, he didn't ever seem to be that involved. I also remember that he did a retelling of the W.W. Jacobs tale, The Monkey's Paw. That they reworked it for modern times on the show, which I thought was really cool. But obviously, knowing what the Monkey's Paw story was and seeing what they did on the show, it was all like, oh, it didn't really ever sit with me as a kid. So, but I think if they did the original Monkey's Paw series, I think it may have been a little too heavy for the kids. So, anything else that anyone wants to sort of bring up on Tales of the Crypt Keeper?
How do you look at the werewolf's collar and decide that it's for a poodle? I mean, because that thing's wider than Dwight. I mean, that thing's wider than Stu. It's like, oh, this is probably for some little poodle. That, I think you could fit a poodle into, but that's just me.
I think it's the name on the bowl, isn't it?
Fifi?
Fifi.
Yeah, Fifi.
Fifi the werewolf.
Maybe they thought that was a full-size poodle.
Yeah, it, I mean, you know, we're poodle, I don't know. Half man, half poodle.
Oh, we're poodle.
We're poodle.
Why has no one picked up on that? I'm sure that's going to be on the new Rick and Marty.
Yeah.
When that finally returns. And just to divert slightly off topic, I have to say that I was destroyed by the end of season 2 of Rick and Morty.
No spoilers, please. I have not. It's not come to Hulu yet that I know of.
I'm not going to spoil it, but...
I have heard. It's pretty devastating.
Yeah, it made me wish that season 3 was like... could follow on straight after it, because I binge-watched pretty much the first two seasons in one go, and oh, it you wouldn't, the ending, as I said, it is pretty brutal, so I'm just going to leave it at that, because obviously if you've not seen season 2 yet, then I won't spoil that one for you.
Yeah, I went through the entire first season in about 2 days, maybe 3, so I'm crawling out of my skin that there is Rick and Morty out there that is not available yet for me to see.
Okay. Bubba Wheat, have you joined the Rick and Morty cult yet?
I have not.
Mr. Zebby?
Yeah, I'm sure that it's a show that I would enjoy, but I just don't have time to watch it. Like, I haven't even watched Daredevil because I didn't cover it for Channel Superhero. Somebody else did. So yeah, it's like I barely have time. Like 90% of what I watch is something that I'm actively writing about on one of my sites, and then I think I give myself one other show that I enjoy. I watch Face Off and Steven Universe, but that's like an 11-minute show, so that doesn't really, I don't really count that. And then anything else is like stuff that I watch because my wife or daughter picks it out.
But yeah, do we have any final thoughts on this one at all? Anything else we want to cover that we haven't done already?
It's interesting that Tales from the Crypt, there. I mean, the whole franchise really does, in a way, boil down to John Cassier's The Crypt Keeper, because with all of the spinoffs and everything, John Cassier is pretty much the only constant. Like, he even popped up in the movies, and he only had like two roles in the actual series. He had one as an actual actor, and then as Lackey mentions, he did the narration in the third pig throughout the whole episode.
But he did it in character as the Crypt Keeper, so. Yeah.
But at least he was like present through the whole episode, not just for the opening and ending like usual. And they even did like a game show that lasted like half a season, I think. That was some really weird. It was like the Crypt Keeper's House of Horror, Haunted Mansion, some really weird long title that made no sense.
Okay.
I would like to buy a vowel.
I think it was kind of like a Double Dare or not exactly Double Dare, but like one of those where it's like an obstacle course style game show.
I don't know if anyone else... Does anyone else get slightly disturbed when the Crypt Keeper kills someone? Because he's sort of like this lovable sort of zombie sort of character. And then at the end of the... Obviously the episode we watched tonight, Comes to Dawn, he's hung someone. And he's sort of like, what? That's like... I don't know how to feel with this, because I'm like... find this character so fun and lovable, and then I'm supposed to also like the fact he's gone and tied a noose around the jock's neck and sort of strangled him.
Well, I mean, he did kick sand in his face.
The jock had it coming. I mean, let's be honest about things here.
So that justifies him lynching.
I don't know. I tend to think of the Crypt Keeper not just in terms of this, but also the role he played, which was a little bit more malicious in the original. I mean, not... He was a little bit more sinister in the original comic books. As kind of like the character that would introduce and out-introduce each story. He had a very similar role in the comic books, but I tend to think of the Crypt Keeper as being a little bit more menacing. So kind of trying to see him as a cuddly character hosting a kids' cartoon show, Tales from the Crypt Keeper I found a little bit more incongruous.
Yeah.
Also, I think he kills someone in the third pig intro as well. I don't entirely remember. I didn't mention that in my when I wrote it up. There's some sort of business with he's looking at scripts for the new season. He's like auditioning writers for the new season of Tales from the Crypt, which is really ironic because it's the last episode they ever produced.
And they do have him doing sort of these malicious things. Like there's another intro where he's like playing the dentist and he has a live person in the dentist chair strapped down and you think that he's going to pull a tooth out, but then he ends up pulling out the guy's tongue. And I believe there's another one where it's like one of the carnival themed episodes and he has someone strapped up to a target where he's like throwing axes at him. And then he throws the axe at the end and they don't show it, but you hear the guy, like it hits the guy.
And my last fun fact about Tales from the Crypt, the Frighteners, Peter Jackson movie, was actually, Peter Jackson actually wrote it with the idea of it being, and pitched it as a Tales from the Crypt movie, and Robert Zemeckis actually turned it down, but ended up helping Peter Jackson produce it independently. Zemeckis felt it was too good to be a Tales from the Crypt movie. But it was one of the ones that was being pitched as the follow-up to Demon Knight.
Yeah, because Demon Knight was the one good movie. Because they only did 3 Tales from the Crypt movies. Demon Knight was a really great one with Billy Zane. And pretty much a whole bunch of other sort of character actors were in there as well.
CCH Pounder, Jada Pinkett.
Yeah.
I always have a problem with Demon Knight. I'm sorry. There is no way in hell I'm ever going to look at any character ever played by Thomas Jaden Church and think that guy's a badass, or that guy is at least credible as a badass. I mean, there's a lot of bluster to that character. Yeah.
Charles Fleischer.
Oh God, yes, Roger Rabbit. The people when I watched that movie, I have to say the people were getting annoyed with me because I kept repeating all of his words, all of his lines in a Roger Rabbit voice. But Eddie.
And of course, William Sadler, who has a long history with Tales from the Crypt. He was in the very first episode of Tales from the Crypt, the man who was death. I believe he was in another episode later in the season, which I don't remember which episode that was. And then, of course, he was like one of the main roles in Demon Knight. And then he also came back in a very bit part in Bordello of Blood, where he plays the mummy and interacts with the Crypt Keeper.
Yeah, and obviously the third movie, Ritual. And Ritual was weird because it was sort of released without the Tales from the Crypt connection. And I think it was only recently, way back in the 2006, that they sort of restored it back to being the Tales from the Crypt movie and put all the Crypt Keeper bits back in. But even here...
I think they actually... I don't know for sure, but I get the impression, because you can tell that the Crypt Keeper in the segments for Ritual is a much, much reduced version than the one that they used in the show and the first two movies. And I believe, if I had to guess, I would say that they shot those sequences for Ritual whenever they were releasing that on DVD at the same time whenever they were releasing the Tales from the Crypt series on DVD, and they made the segments for the DVD menus And you can tell that that's also a very like stripped down version of the Crypt Keeper. And I, if I had to guess, I would say that they used that same stripped down version for the segments that they added into Ritual.
Yeah. Well, I know here in the UK when they showed Demon Knight on TV, the BBC decided that it might confuse people to have the Crypt Keeper intro and outro, so they cut it out. So they you get, instead of the intro, you just get the random laughter of the Crypt Keeper, which obviously all the fans of the show and even like fans of the cartoon series know who the Crypt Keeper is. But it just was like, why is it called Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, when there's no Crypt Keeper in this? It made no sense. So yeah, thanks a lot, BBC, for screwing up something else. They also have a family-friendly version of Kindergarten Cop, where they basically edit out like any like good part of the film to make this weird sort of family movie cut that they have. Yeah, just enough of my ongoing gripes with the BBC. So,
but, yes, well, at least you only have one network over in your country doing that.
Yeah, and we're forced to pay for it, and I don't even watch it. As I said before, I'm paying for the TV service that you like to watch. And to like.
Yeah, I have to say, I really appreciate the sacrifice you're taking on my behalf, paying your license fee to fund all my individual obsessions.
It's like the unique way that we fund Daniel Lackey's TV viewing. So
I honestly have to say, because there's no way I'd be able to afford all that stuff on my own.
So, but obviously, to want to put a quick thank you out to a few people for obviously their support, not only of this episode, but also the Blogathon. So in no particular order, I'd like to obviously thank Emily and Christine over at the Feminine Critique, the guys over at Podcast Town, as well as the Junk Food Dinner podcast, who are also doing their own Tales from the Crypt episode. They're actually beating us, because I think they're doing 6 or 8 episodes on their show, while we manage 2. So good luck, guys. And Pool Party Radio, if you like Who's Afraid of the Dark, they're also covering a whole bunch of episodes this month on their show as well. So plenty of horror nostalgia going around. And thank you again to those guys for letting us steal some space on their site to obviously promote the Blogathon and that. So thank you again for that. Also, thank you to Bubba Wheat for coming on and sharing your thoughts on Tales from the Crypt and putting together the Blogathon that's obviously inspired tonight's episode.
Sure thing.
Hopefully we can get you back on to discuss some more shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Lucky, what are you chosen for your selection for the next episode?
This is a little bit unusual, but because I have chosen an entire season of a show for the next episode, but it is a short season of short episodes. It's 5 25-minute long episodes, so you should be able to watch it in about 2 hours. It's a Canadian series from the early 2010s called The Booth at the End. It only ran for 2 seasons, and I think was mainly distributed through the web and digital streaming platforms, but it is a fascinating little series starring character actor Xander Berkeley as a mysterious man who appears to be able to have the power to grant wishes, but at what price?
For my selection, we're going to be looking at going back to season 1 of Buffy with episode 8. We're going to look at iRobot Eugene, which is the main reason I picked it is just purely because it's a chance to look back at those late 90s vision of what the internet was going to be. And there's a particular famous speech in that one, which you're going to have to hear next week. But yeah, we're going to be looking at iRobot Eugene, which is worth watching just for a robot demon. And also one of the first Willow-centric episodes of the season. So looking forward to revisiting that one. In the meantime, if you obviously want to drop us a line, you can do either on the Facebook page, just look up TV Good Sleep Bad. We're also on Twitter, again at TV Good Sleep Bad. Bubba Wheat, if people want to find your where's the best place they can find you?
Well, they can find me at flightsitesmovienights.com. They can find me at channelsuperhero.com. On Twitter, I'm at Bubba Wheat, and Channel Superhero is at CH_Superhero, and we have DJ Valentine doing our live tweets for us. He live tweets Gotham, The Flash, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and Arrow. And those are a lot of fun if you watch those live on the East Coast.
Cool. And if you got anything in particular coming up on your sites at the moment?
I do have an interview coming up. I believe I'll be promoting it on both sites. I talked to one of the writers of an anthology film that had just come out called Tales of Halloween, and it's a really fun. It's actually partly inspired by Tales from the Crypt. It has that really campy humor in it, and it's a really fun movie. And the writer director I talked to, Andrew Cash, he is also an editor on The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow. So we talked about those episodes a little bit in the interview, and it was a lot of fun talking to him.
Well, thanks again, Bud Wick, for coming on the show this evening. Also, thank you, as always, to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Thank you, sir.
Leaves me nothing else to do but say this is Edward Jones. Sign off another edition of TV Good, Sleep Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange.